Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints represents a remarkable success story in the world of religious denominations. Despite an early history of intense persecution, which included its forcible eviction from several states and the violent death of its founder, Joseph Smith, the Mormon Church today stands as the fourth largest denomination in the United States, with roughly 6 million adherents, ranking only behind Catholics, Southern Baptists, and United Methodists in terms of total membership. Globally, the LDS Church claims a membership of roughly 13.5 million. And over the past half century, Mormons have maintained a growth rate of approximately 50% per decade, a remarkable achievement for any denomination its age and size. Perhaps more impressive than the number of adherents to Mormonism is the level of commitment and overall satisfaction that members exhibit. Unlike many Christian churches that can only count on financial contributions of roughly 2% of their members' gross income, the Latter-day Saints ask for, and come close to getting, 10% of their members' pre-tax income. Add to this the high number of volunteer hours given by their members. Compared to most other denominations, the Mormon Church is largely run on the basis of voluntary service. All of this is combined with a high level of satisfaction among its members. Data from the 1989 General Social Survey revealed that the average Mormon rated his or her satisfaction with his or her church at an average of 3.8 on a 4.0 scale, with 4 representing very satisfied. This compares with conservative evangelical Christians at 3.1, liberal mainline Protestants at 2.3, and Roman Catholics averaging a response of 2.1. How have the Latter-day Saints been able to maintain such high growth rates and achieve such remarkable levels of commitment and satisfaction? To help us answer this question, I am joined today by Michael McBride, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of California, Irvine. Professor McBride conducts research on a wide range of topics, including political economy, game theory, network analysis, and most apropos for our topic today, the economics of religion. I should also note that Mike is affiliated with a number of research centers at UCI, including the Center for the Study of Democracy, the Institute for Mathematical Behavior Sciences, and UC Irvine's Religious Studies Program. Mike, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me, Tony, and thanks a lot for the podcast. I'm one of your biggest fans.
That's great, and we're hopefully going to have a growing audience here, and I think our conversation today is definitely going to be very stimulating for folks out there. I should note that Mike's university, and I used to live down in the Irvine area when I was going to graduate school at UCLA, happens to have one of the best mascots in the entire collegiate world. And Mike, what is that mascot?
Yeah, we have the anteater as our mascot.
The anteater, right? Yeah. You know, that is one ferocious animal. It's surely guaranteed to strike fear in the hearts of all your opponents. And
yeah, I'm sure it does. You know, it really dates the school. The school was founded in the mid-1960s, mm-hmm. and when the students voted on the mascot, they didn't want some fierce bear or lion. They got an anteater.
And, you know, there it is. unique in the world of college mascots, I believe.
For sure.
I want to talk about two of your most recent papers, You actually write quite a bit. One of them is called Club Mormon, Free Riders, Monitoring, and Exclusions in the LDS Church, which was published recently in Rationality and Society. And the other paper, Why Churches Need Free Riders, Religious Capital Formation and Religious Group Survival, which is currently a working paper. We're going to provide links for folks to these papers on our website, so you can check them out for yourself. They're excellent reads, not too mathematical for anybody who's a little bit scared of economics. And they also the topic of these papers actually meshes very well with two recent podcasts we did with Ellie Berman on religious violence and Mark Vonderer on megachurch recruitment. So these things tie together, and I urge listeners to check out those podcasts as well. So let's start with the Club Mormon paper. You base your analysis of Mormon success on something known as the club model of organizations. Could you tell us a little bit about what that club model is?
Sure. Yeah. So a club is a term in economics that refers to a voluntary group that shares the cost of production of certain goods that are what we call excludable. So that means that people that aren't in the group can't access the good. So there are lots of kinds of these clubs. So you could think of things we normally think of as clubs, like a country club,
mm-hmm.
or a local gym. But families, to an extent, are a type of club. Or maybe something that people belong to, like a book club. I think thinking about a book club is a really useful way to understand what a club is.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe I could use that as an example here. So if you join a book club, you want to join because of the intellectual stimulation or the social friendships that you will will be fostered, and you enjoy meeting with people talking about ideas. But the quality of that participation is going to depend on the efforts that everyone makes, not just what you make, but what everyone makes. And so this is what in economics we call a positive externality. So you need joint production because everyone's got to be involved. You can't have a one-person book club. But there are these positive externalities so that my efforts influence other people's benefits and vice versa. But of course, if you make the effort and I shirk a little bit, then I can get a lot of benefits without making much effort in reading beforehand, thinking of great discussion questions, coming up with new insights. And so I'm tempted to free ride, that is, receive benefits of participation without contributing, or easy ride. Maybe I'll contribute a little bit, but not in proportion to the types of benefits that I want to receive. And so this is a key organizational concern of any club,
mm-hmm.
To limit free riding. And so you can try to limit free riding in lots of ways. A gym buys an ID card maker. They put up a gate. They have a computer track fees. And whoever pays their dues gets an ID card, and they can go in and participate in the club.
Right.
A book club, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense in a book club. So maybe they recruit members through their social network. Maybe they even go a lot farther and they say, well, you can only be in our club if you have a PhD in English or something. And so they do various things that they hope will select into the group people that are more likely to contribute and to the group, and so there are different methods that different groups undertake, and the types of methods they undertake will depend on the costs and benefits of the different methods for overcoming the free rider problem.
Mm-hmm.
But so you know, these such groups are ubiquitous. You find them everywhere, and you know, in this literature on the economics of religion, one of the key ideas is that religious groups have some of these features, that they are clubs in the economic sense of it.
Yeah, I can see how that works out, too, because I've been to, you know, when you think about the club good that is actually being provided, one of the things you can think of is just the fellowship of the service. And I've been to a number of churches where, you know, nobody's really singing. They're all just kind of mumbling along. And that's, you know, that doesn't do much for me. But when everybody else is singing, it's a much different type of environment in that regard. And your analogy of the book club is I think, very easy to understand here. And it's, I think, a good way to for me to explain this to my students. I never thought about this before. But, you know, if there's 10 people there and I'm the only one who's read the book, I'm carrying the weight of the group. And I start wondering, well, why am I even bothering with this? And everybody else who hasn't read it saying, well, yeah, please tell me about it. And I'll enjoy the muffins and cookies as well.
Yeah, so it just ends up everyone shirks, and then everyone just ends up gossiping about their neighbors rather than talking about the book because no one read it.
Right. So I can imagine how maybe that the free rider problem is fairly easy to solve for a book club of a dozen or so members. You can shun the individual and say, hey, you know, if you don't read it, please don't come back next time. But what about churches that can run into the dozens or hundreds or even thousands of members?
Yeah, that's right. So so this is one of the key questions. So so Larry Iannacone, whose name we haven't mentioned yet, but I know his name has come up in earlier podcasts, particularly the one with Ellie Berman, he argued that you should think about religious groups as clubs. Obviously, they're not doing exactly the same thing that a local country club is doing or that a book group is doing, but there are these common features we've been talking about. And so, you know, what does a religious group, you know, try to do? Well, how does it overcome this freewriter problem? Well, one of the problems is it's hard to figure out who's freewriting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so who, when you're, you know, maybe you're in the church and you're singing the hymns and someone's mouthing the words, but they're not really singing. You know, can you really tell who's contributing to the singing? Or
yeah, I've been asked not to sing, actually. So
yeah, okay, well, that's how you can contribute. So he made a very brilliant observation, and this is one of probably the most important contribution to our understanding of religion that's come out of economics, is that religious groups have to solve this problem in some different ways. They can't solve it the same way that the local gym solves the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what Larry observed was that churches that have free rider problems often try to deal with them. Now, not all churches do this, but they often try to deal with this by screening members in some somewhat odd ways that appear on the surface to be odd and irrational or just not, they don't make much sense. And he observed that lots of churches require their members to do various sorts of things that produce stigmas. So one example would be you have to wear a very particular hairstyle that makes you really stand out, or you have to wear some particular type of clothing that really makes you stand out. And this behavior is one that the rest of society doesn't exactly approve of, and it generates a stigma for the person that undertakes this behavior. And this directly imposes a cost. It's a non-monetary cost, but it's a cost on the person that undertakes this behavior. And if the group says, you know what, you're going to have to do this thing, that's going to give you a cost. If you want to be in our group, then this is going to screen people out. Some people are just going to say, you know, I don't really want to join that group if I have to do that. And other people those people that are more likely, once joining the group, to be more committed to the group, they're the ones that are willing to pay this cost. And so by actually forcing potential members to pay an extra cost, you're actually weeding people out. You're weeding out the people that would more likely to be free riders, and you're screening in the people that would be less likely to be free riders, all because of this stigmatizing cost. And Larry showed that the churches, so this is this theory that he has, and he showed that the churches that have more of these behavioral requirements tend to have higher levels of certain forms of commitment. Like they have higher attendance,
mm-hmm.
they have members that profess beliefs to larger degrees. And so what Larry did was he provided this very rich theoretical explanation for some empirical patterns that had been really puzzling to people. So there's a famous book written by a guy named Dean Kelly called Why Conservative Churches Are Growing.
Right.
And he wrote that in the 1970s, and this raised a real puzzle. He observed that these stricter churches were thriving, but yet there wasn't a real theoretical understanding for it, and that's exactly what Larry provided.
Mm-hmm. We have mentioned those papers a few times before, and not only is it an interesting paper for the study of religion, but I think Iannacone's paper there is incredibly important for just our general understanding of a collective action. And I've mentioned before how, you know, this can and help with a number of other or help understanding a number of other goods such as gangs, or, you know, Ellie Berman put this to use in terms of terrorist groups and the like. There's one question I always had though with Larry's paper, and I think this is where you make some interesting modifications of it, but if you follow Larry's model, it tends to have this linear sense to it, that the stricter the church is, the more successful or more committed individuals will be, and that seems to be the case, but it doesn't necessarily lead to attracting members in that regard. So you could have a very, very strict organization such as the Amish, which you have to give up your cell phones, you have to give up electricity and that. But they're not likely to grow as fast as any other churches because people probably feel that these stigmas or these behaviors that they have to engage in are just way too strict. So is it the case that there might be too much strictness and that might be damaging a church, or what were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. So when I teach my economics of religion class here at UC Irvine, this is a point that we talk about. Strictness is really a relative concept. So you could be kind of you could have strictness of a small nature, you could have strictness of a large nature, but there's in a sense there's a type of optimal strictness for a group that wants to grow. If you're not strict enough, you're not getting high efforts. That's Larry's theory. But you could be too strict. I mean, so David Koresh, right?
Right.
Texas, they're pretty much done, right? I mean, they're not. This is not a growing religious group. The Amish, they grow at a fairly moderate rate, if they even grow at all. If you're too strict, the costs are too high, and you don't get enough new blood. And so for growth, what it appears is that there's a medium range of strictness that if a church finds, it's able to grow at a pretty fast rate. Now, this raises lots of questions. Well, why are some groups not strict? Why are other groups really strict? Why are some groups medium strict? This is a really hard question to answer. I don't have a good answer to that. You know, maybe part of it has to do with the particular objectives of a religious group or what the leaders of that group see as their primary mission and purpose. But it does seem pretty clear that religious groups that have a certain amount of real strictness, but it's not so high that it just completely makes it too costly for members to participate, then those are the churches that really seem to grow rapidly.
In terms of that growth, too, and this is, I believe, where your free riders paper comes in, that you need to have some free riders if you're going to grow. I mean, you go back to the book club and you have a group of five people and you say, oh, wouldn't it be great if we had 12 people? And so you invite some people in, and usually the first thing you hear and when you invite new people in says, oh, don't worry about participating your first time out or your second time out. Just go ahead and sit and listen and just become more comfortable. So you allow people to free ride. And I think that's the essence of your free riding paper. Is that right?
Yeah. So in the paper I wrote about the Mormon church, that was one of the key ideas that I wanted to come out. And then in the second paper that you mentioned, that's the idea that I'm really trying to flesh out more generally and really look at it from all the angles. But yeah, that's exactly the spirit of it. Larry's theory really looks at what in economics we call as the static free rider problem. If you want to produce really high quality club goods today, you've got to limit free riding today. But and Larry would acknowledge this. There's a whole dynamic side to organizations, and particularly to religious commitment. Religious commitment is a dynamic phenomenon. Someone may be more committed today than they were yesterday. They may be less committed tomorrow than they are today. And a religious group that is interested in growing over time is not just thinking about producing the highest quality club good today. They've got to be concerned about getting people that are committed tomorrow and the day after and the year after and the decade after. And so what they have to do is they have to dynamically manage the free riding. They, in fact, might have to allow some free riding today so that people will participate in the group and then develop the commitment and then tomorrow become the highly committed core people that really help produce the club good. So this is something that Larry's theory doesn't address. Now, I've talked to him. I think he understands that his paper wasn't meant to answer all questions about religious groups. But,
right.
But I think it's as equal a part to the story as the story that Larry's paper originally told.
Yeah, that's one of the issues that we dealt with in that earlier podcast with Mark Fonderer on megachurches. One of the big puzzles that always came up was in relation to Larry's paper was, well, these churches are so huge, how can you, you know, and they try really fitting into the culture at large, so how could anybody really become committed to these churches? According to Larry's theory, these things should usually collapse. But, you know, what Mark found and what other folks who researched this, such as Scott Thuma and that, find is that, you know, initially they let you free ride for a little bit, but they say, listen, if you want to stay here for a while, you got to up the ante a little bit, start participating in more small groups, or, you know, commit to X amount of dollars or X amount of volunteer time throughout the, as you grow in your membership. And so I think that's a really interesting insight that, to some extent, we think of free riders as always being a bad thing for groups, but what you bring to the table is that, you know, free riding can be very important for an organization's growth.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of it's an odd thing. A language is an issue here. When I've presented this idea at conferences, I've had people raise their hands. Yeah, but you know, those people aren't free riders. They're recruits. You know, and then I have to say, well, yeah, we need to enhance our language here. They're free riders in the sense that they're not contributing to the production, that they're draining resources. The benefits that are being produced on their part are taking away from benefits that could be produced for other people. And but yet, there's nothing that's inherently negative about this. So the term free rider carries this negative connotation. And so I'm trying to say we need to recognize that they're free riders of a sort, but that there's a role for this in the organization, and that so we don't want to think about all free riding as some sort of bad thing, as it's often described.
Well, let's go ahead and talk more about the empirical aspect now of the Latter-day Saints, which you do a wonderful job of detailing all of this in your Club Mormon paper. And again, I want to urge our listeners to check out the link to this paper. I know many people are always worried about papers written by economists. It's all filled with lots of equations and Greek letters and stuff. But this one is not. It's written in such a way that, you know, the average person without calculus training could easily understand. And it's also a wonderful introduction, I found, into the organizational structure of the Latter-day Saints. So why don't you give us some insight on that? How is the Mormon Church organized?
Okay, so first off, let me clarify. The official name of the church is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And
right.
Mormon is a nickname, and I'll use those terms interchangeably. But when we think about the church, it's useful to distinguish between what we call the local level of the church and then the general level of the church. And along the way, I'll distinguish between the hierarchical elements of the LDS church and the democratic elements of the church. There's a relatively small number, given the sheer size of the church, there's a relatively small number of full-time clergy that have what Mormons call stewardship over the entire church. There's a council called the First Presidency, and there's a council called the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, and they make all the important decisions about what are church policies, what are church doctrines, and church members consider them to be prophets and revelators. And they're called general authorities because their authority extends over the entire membership. And there are dozens of other general authorities called 70s and a few others who help administrate under the direction of the First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. And then, of course, there's a large bureaucratic staff.
Right.
That's not that's where people work full-time jobs, but they're not ecclesiastical positions. But these are the full-time paid positions. Now, there's a lot of top-down control with doctrine, policies, curriculum, even extends to finances, so that the experience of someone attending a Mormon church in, say, I don't know, Alabama, is the same as it is in Utah, and very similar to what it is in Nigeria, even. But the lived experience for members doesn't occur in this realm of the general authorities. It occurs at the local level, and here things are quite different. The local unit is called a ward, or a branch if it's a smaller congregation. You can think of this as being like a parish, but usually they're a bit smaller in size than a Catholic parish. There's no paid clergy at all at the local level. All the positions are done on a voluntary basis positions are referred to as callings. The idea is that a person is asked, who's asked to take a particular responsibility, is being called by God through the local leader to take this responsibility. So, for example, the leader of the congregation is called a bishop. This bishop has a full-time job, works 40 hours a week or more at the job, and then contributes a bunch of hours as the leader of the congregation. And there are various types of positions. There are lots of committees, some that head up social activities, some that head up Sunday school, some that head up missionary work. Others have more ministering responsibilities to members of the congregation that have particular needs. But all of these positions are rotated. So the bishop is usually in place for about 5 years. There may be a leader of the social activities committee, and that person's the leader of it for a year or two. And so everyone gets a chance to participate, and they get lots of experience, and they have opportunities to contribute their time and their talents in various ways.
Now, is the bishop a paid position? Do they? You mentioned that they work 40 hours per week, and I can imagine if that's just a voluntary position, you could live a very stressful life if you have to maintain
a second job. Yeah, let me clarify. So the bishop would work 40 hours a week at his regular job.
Okay.
And then he'd work anywhere from, who knows, from 10 to 20 hours a week doing his bishop responsibilities.
I see. Okay.
So the bishop might be a realtor, could be a police officer, could be a truck driver. Well, a truck driver might be hard to be in town, but it could be particularly any sort of job the bishop could potentially have. And then that's just all part of regular life. And then the bishop responsibilities are all on top of that. And so he's not paid for his bishop responsibilities.
And so one really has to be dedicated in order for that to, you know, be your calling. That's just kind of amazing to think of.
Yeah, that's right. And so the bishop would probably be the one calling in the ward that requires the most time and effort. But there are other callings that require a similar amount. That's right. You have to be pretty committed to accept a position like that, because a lot is expected of you. And, you know, and as being a leader in any sort of voluntary organization, you know that sometimes the job is not always easy.
Right. No, I can imagine. There's one question I want to ask you. You mentioned about the wards and branches, which might be a smaller one, and the relationship to some we haven't talked about yet is the stake. I have some friends who belong to a ward, and what is very interesting when I went and talked with them was that they're in a physical building, but they also have another ward that shares that physical building.
Mm-hmm.
Which is amazing. I mean, the size of a ward is fairly capped, right?
That's right. So a ward is, so the wards can vary in size. Usually they're between, you know, 200 to 600 or 700 people. But once they get too big, then it's a matter of church practice that the boundaries will be split. So wards, so this is something different about Mormon wards when compared to other denominations, congregations. Mormon wards have very, very explicit boundaries. And you are supposed to attend the ward in where you live, okay, so that you don't have shopping around where, oh, I like the bishop over in that other ward, I'm just going to go over there, or I like the bishop who's across the city, I go over there. Members are strongly encouraged to attend the wards where they reside, so there's much more of a community feel.
Mm-hmm.
And because buildings are expensive to maintain, for many years now, you often have many wards that share the same building, and then they'll stagger their services in a way where they can share. You know, one ward is meeting in the chapel for the primary service, and then another ward is using some of the classes around, holding their Sunday school at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something very different.
Hey, I found that just absolutely fascinating, and I mean, in part, you'll never see a Mormon mega church with a specific congregation of several thousand people. Is there something in that size specification that helps to manage the free riding problem? It seems to me that roughly 600 people is an upper limit of just basically creating a community that's large, which is nice, but which is still small, that it's relatively intimate.
I think there is, and so yes, in the ways that you're thinking of, and maybe in some ways that you haven't thought of. One of the main ideas that has been applied to free riding in churches has to do with social networks and how social networks help enforce good behavior. And by increasing the amount of interactions among the people, you are able to improve commitment. By requiring the wards to be capped in size, you're enforcing a smaller, more intimate set of relationships among the ward members, because pretty much 90% of the lived experience of a Mormon occurs within that ward. You go to ward social events, you worship together on Sunday, you participate in your calling with other people in the ward, and these may require lots of time that you spend together, and so you really get to know the people in your ward, and forcing the wards to be small keeps those those connections tighter. So that's something that I think the sociologists have known. There's another element, I think, which may be uniquely Mormon. If you have a ward, and a functioning ward has a certain number of responsibilities to be fully staffed, if you have too many people, you've got a lot of people that really don't have a lot of well-defined positions and jobs. And by keeping the ward small, you really can try to get everyone a position in the ward that really is meaningful. And so that helps to improve their participation and commitment. And I think that's something that's kind of unique about the Mormons.
Yeah, I think about that in terms of Mansur Olson's logic of collective action argument, where he talks about the free rider problem as a calculation from the individual's side, with the individual asking, well, what do I actually contribute to the group, and is it really worth it to me? If I'm not contributing a whole lot, then I'm not going to do much. But so it sounds like what you're saying is that by keeping these at a certain level, a certain size, that there's enough jobs there that when somebody is given a job, they actually have some degree of responsibility where they can see the effects of their job and say, yeah, you know, I'm a critical part of this community.
I think that's right. I think that's important in any sort of voluntary organization, and really in churches as one example of that. I think it's pretty important.
Now, one of the things in terms of, before I get to that question, I want to ask what a stake is, because
okay,
this is
so,
something I oftentimes mistake with.
I should spell it out. It's not like steak and eggs. It's a stake, spelled S-T-A-K-E. It's a funny word, but it's a biblical word. So you read in the Old Testament about the stakes of Zion. So Zion is like this giant tent, and the stakes help to hold up this tent where it gives a home to the people of God. That's the image that we get. And so it's a stake. It tries to, the word uses that imagery, but a stake is just a collection of wards that are geographically in the same location. And so you can compare it to, like, diocese, for example. So usually you have about 6 or 10 wards in a stake. The stake has leaders. Now, these leaders come from the wards. So these people, like, there's a stake presidency, but the members of the stake presidency come from various wards in the stake, and these are also not paid positions. So the stake president might be, again, could be a lawyer or have some other responsibility in the secular world. But they have responsibilities to help train ward leaders, and they have some ministering responsibilities, and there are various positions at the stake level, but they're all staffed by members of the wards. And just one other point, which I don't think is in the paper, but it's interesting that the Mormon Church doesn't have any certification or credential process for even the full-time clergy at the general level. All apostles and other figures, they were just regular people, you know, working in a ward at some point, maybe running the activities, and then they eventually gained lots of experience, and then they were selected and asked to become a full-time worker. So there's no formal educational training, or there's no degree that they have. They're all regular people who end up, just because of their experience, and of course, as Mormons would say, they've been called of God to then take on a position at a higher level.
Yeah, it's a really interesting organizational aspect of this, or, you know, people are volunteers. voluntarily called, or as you may say, from God to do these positions. And it's, the rotation of memberships in there gives everybody experience and everybody a different position to fulfill. It's one can already start to see how, building the commitment in the church is completed just because everybody's involved.
I think this is something we'll get to later, but I think there's another really important aspect of this is it increases the opportunity that people interact with one another, and people kind of reveal their commitment levels often.
Mm-hmm.
And so, people that maybe asked to serve in positions of greater responsibility are likely ones that have already displayed that they're pretty committed through all the other opportunities they've had to serve in the ward, and so they gain lots of experience, and so then it's realized that this is going to be a good person to have this very important position of leadership in a ward.
Let me turn us a little bit now to the issue of what club goods are being provided to the congregation as a whole or to the ward as a whole. We talked earlier about one of the ways you can think of a religious club good is just the general fellowship that you might get at a service, people singing with one another, and the fellowship that you enjoy after the service or something like that. But the Latter-day Saints go a little bit further. What are some of the different types of club goods that are provided? And you talk about this as being a menu of club goods. Explain what that means.
Okay. So you're right on the nose. There are lots of things that lots of benefits of being a member of the LDS Church, and some of them are exactly similar to what you'd find in other churches. Lots of fellowship. Maybe some of these are gone to maybe a greater extent. So, for example, in addition to building friendships on Sunday when you attend a meeting, a church service, you will also get each month an in-home visit from someone in the ward, and they come and you talk about how your lives are going, and the person may share an inspirational thought, and this helps build ties.
Mm-hmm.
When a person is struggling financially, there are welfare services, and so a person may have help getting their rent paid, or there are things called the bishop's storehouse, think of it as a grocery store, except you have to have a bishop's permission to go there, and once you go there, you can come out with bags full of groceries if you can't buy your own food. There are many weekday activities for all sorts. Of course, there are ritual activities, and some of these are occur in the temples, which are not regular congregational meeting houses, so some of these things sound a lot like what you find in another church, but maybe taken to a greater degree. There's something odd that that if you want to move, if you need to move, oftentimes you'll get members of the church to come out and move you. Now this is like one of the strangest things, but it just turns out to be a really valuable benefit that you could get help in packing up a moving truck.
I actually have a personal story to share on this, and just how amazed I am at how tightly knit these communities are and how they respond to one another. I was in Provo, Utah, giving a talk at BYU several years ago, and had a friend down there and asked him if we could go to a basketball game. He said, yeah, he got us tickets. I was supposed to be picked up at the hotel, and he gave me a call on my cell phone and said, hey, I'm going to be a little bit late. And I said, no problem. That's not that big a deal. And he explained to me what had happened is that that day there was an automobile accident for one of the members in the ward, and the whole community just rallied around this person. And I, it was just such an amazing thing to see. You see this in other churches, but I don't think, to the extent that the Latter-day Saints can do this, it's quite amazing that they're able to do this. The other thing I should note, too, is I've been working on a research project that looks at the relationship between government-provided welfare and private-provided welfare. And one of the things that really sticks out in the data that we've been looking at is that Utah has very low per capita expenditures in terms of social welfare provision from the government. But then you think about this, they say, well, with the majority of the population there being with the Latter-day Saints, they don't really need it. They already have a built-in social welfare network that is incredibly strong.
Yeah, there are these great stories of when the the modern welfare system in the LDS Church was being developed in the earlier part of the 20th century, that, you know, the people from the federal government would come and ask the Mormons, "Oh, how are you doing this? How are you organizing this?" Mm-hmm. So I mean, I don't know to what extent that influenced how anything was done at the federal level, but they're great stories.
No, it really is, and I think anybody who's interested in the, you know, social provision of welfare services, I mean, would do well by looking at this kind of community-based grassroots type of model, which it seems to be working very well. But I guess that brings up the issue of free riding here. With such an extensive social welfare network that you can always count on somebody in your ward with a pickup truck to help you move on any given day, there would just seem to be a huge temptation to free ride, to absorb some of these social welfare benefits and help with moving, but not necessarily have to contribute.
Yeah, so that's the... Oh, I'm sorry, I cut you off.
No. I was finished there, so go ahead.
That's the question, right? So let me state from the front that I don't think Larry's theory would argue that churches eliminate free riding altogether. It's a matter of limiting it as best as possible. But the motivation behind that, the one paper about the Mormon Church that I wrote, was really just trying to say, you know, how do they limit free riding, and how good are they at doing so? And because there is free riding in churches, even in Mormon churches, and you know, there are plenty of opportunities to free ride. But it's surprising that there's not more of it that happens, I guess. And but there are some other things about Larry's theory that I think are puzzling when we think about the Mormon Church. And then let me mention some of these things and come back to about maybe how effective these things are. As I looked at how things occur just on a day-to-day level in an LDS congregation, it just really pops out that the truth is a lot more subtle and more complex than Larry's theory lets on. That's not a criticism of his theory, because I'm a big fan of it. But it's just an observation that a lot of these benefits that we talked about are not distributed exactly equally among the members. Some certain things, like, for example, a participation in temple rituals, is reserved only for people who really exhibit and confess to exhibiting the highest levels of commitment.
Now, what would a temple ritual be, and why would that be a big deal?
Well, the rituals of salvation in the LDS, so you have rituals like baptism, which are common across lots of Christian denominations, and that's a common ritual in the LDS Church. But there are other rituals in the LDS Church that are of additional significance. So, for example, the idea of having what we call an eternal marriage, where a husband and wife can be married in a temple done by a Mormon priesthood holder, in a way that makes their marriage valid in the next life, not only this life. That's something that's done only in temples, and it's not done in regular meeting houses. And so having that privilege, the benefit of having your marriage sealed, in the Mormon words, forever, is something that is only available to people that are abiding by all the principles and teachings of the church.
Let me explore that a little bit. That's interesting. So not everybody gets married in a temple.
That's right.
And usually, though, marriages comes at an early stage in life. You know, demographically, we're starting to get married a little bit older nowadays, but we're talking in, you know, probably the early 20s or so. So how is it that you know that somebody by their early 20s has been committed enough to get married in the temple?
Well, the way you get into a temple is you meet with your bishop, and the bishop asks you a few questions, and if you answer them pretty well, then you get a special card that allows you entrance into a temple. It's that simple. Now, you could say, well, people could lie and say that they paid their tithing when they didn't, or something. But, you know, and that might happen. There's no way to know for sure. I suppose it does to some degree.
It's just interesting. It comes, you know, so early in life, and this is after your teenage years, and I can, you know, only imagine that teenagers are really not committed to anything.
Yeah, Yeah, that's right. And I let me make sure I don't give a wrong impression. You don't have to be a perfect individual to enter the temple. You just have to abide by by certain standards. You need to not be committing adultery, or you need to be paying your tithing. You need to be living what's called the Word of Wisdom, which is the Mormon health code that is somewhat well known. And then you have to, agree that you believe in Jesus Christ and so some other things. So there's some belief questions. There are some behavior questions. It's like 10 questions. It's not that big. But by going through the process of actually meeting with a bishop and confessing that you're living these standards, not everyone's willing to do that, actually.
Yeah, I can imagine that if you want to put yourself up to being married in temple, you're taking this commitment very seriously, and it's not something they say, oh yeah, we'll kind of fool our way into doing this, and afterwards, oh well, because you don't consider it to be very serious. So I guess it's a kind of a self-selection process for those who are most committed.
And people are really, I think that's right, and people are really encouraged to go. There's not an idea of, oh, you didn't deserve to go to the temple. shame on you. It's more of, look, everyone, we want everyone to go, and we want everyone to be worthy of it is the word that's used, and there's doctrinal teachings behind it, and the idea that makes the temple experience more valuable to a person because they've really committed themselves to being there and whatnot. So but I think it is a fascinating aspect of the Mormon Church.
Let me ask you another one of these questions that it really caught my attention in your paper, in terms of the provision of these public goods or these club goods to individuals, was that my thought would be that only the very best people would get these club goods provided to them, the in-home visits or assistance in times of need or trouble. But as you indicated here with the marriage in the temple, there's this degree of encouragement. Yeah, we want you all to succeed. And you'd mentioned in the paper that actually people who are a little bit more, what you could say, free-riding, tend to be ones who get the visits. Actually, it's not a one-to-one trade-off that you'll see that the ward leaders reach out to people who might be struggling in their commitment.
Yeah, this is something that really stood out to me as I started thinking about the Mormon Church in this way, is that there are lots of benefits of membership that are quite easy for, say, local ward leaders to deny to someone. But they're not only not denied, they're like emphatically not denied. So home visits, for example, local ward leaders want everyone in the ward, especially those who don't attend church, they want them to receive these visits. Maybe helping someone move, even something like that. There are benefits where the local ward just stands ready to just bestow these benefits on people. And there are some where it's like, well, if you want to go to the temple, no, you've actually got to come to church, and you've got to pay your tithing. But no, if you're not paying your tithing, oh, come to church anyway, and you attend and enjoy Sunday school. Even if you don't read, enjoy Sunday school, and please accept our visits, and can we send you email newsletters and everything. And so this to me was where I said, hey, this doesn't really match this original theory,
right,
that we're working from, and this is where I started thinking about the free riding really being a dynamic phenomenon. And there's a term in economics called capital, which is something that you produce that's used to produce something else.
Right, like a hammer.
Physical, physical capital would be an example. Would be a hammer or a phone. There's human capital, which may be the skills or education that is produced in a person to help them undertake some task. And then there's something called religious capital, which is a type of human capital, but also a type of social capital that really ties a person to a particular religious group. And, oddly enough, this, Larry Iannacone also gets credit for the idea of religious capital, but he didn't really link it with his free rider paper. But when you put those two together, you realize, committed members, they're not born. They're actually produced.
Right.
And so a church has got to let people develop that capital and maybe let them free ride while they're doing so.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can become really committed people. Now, not everyone is going to become committed. So this is a really, from the point of view of the church organization, to use, it might sound like profane language, but these people are investments in the church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a risky investment because not everyone who participates will develop the commitment. And it's very costly because a lot of resources are expended in helping to produce that capital and the people. Resources that could be used to help the people that are already committed. And so, but from an organizational point of view, it's a part of life if the group wants to grow over time.
Yeah, and this is the issue of growth becomes important there. I mean, I guess we could have, you know, a very closed community of chosen people that if you pay a very high price, sacrifice up front, or engage in stigmatizing behavior, you're part of the group, and maybe that's what we want. But if you want to grow, you do. I mean, as you say, I think you put this very well, is that you have to produce commitment. And I, now that I think about this, a lot of our language in economics of organization and talking about these free rider problems are, seem to be a very black and white. If you don't do this, you get punished clearly. But you have, as you mentioned, you have to look at this in a much more dynamic realm and bringing in that whole issue of religious capital. You can see that somebody who's not committed to the ward all of a sudden gets a home visit saying, hey, here you're having some problems, we're going to help you out here. And then you start saying, oh, you know, these people are okay to hang out with, maybe I'll see him next Sunday, and it builds upon that. So it's a brilliant model.
Yeah. And if you think about it even like more concretely, you say, well, but still, if these people are free riding, and suppose someone's been free riding for 10 years,
mm-hmm.
You say, is it still worth it for an organization to devote effort towards really trying to bring that person into the fold? And you might say, you know, it might be, because it certainly would be, this is a person that already has shown some interest,
mm-hmm.
and some, they have some connection, maybe they're married to someone who is more of an active participating member, but they're not. Trying to help that person improve their commitment might be more effective than just picking a random person off the street.
Right.
And helping that person develop more commitment. So it might seem counterintuitive to the whole notion of free riding, but yet if you think about it the way you said it, you know, in this bigger picture, it makes an there's an organizational logic to it.
Mm-hmm. We have about 8 or so minutes left on our podcast, and here's one issue I want to throw out to you. You don't directly address this, and we actually hinted around it at the very beginning of the podcast, but the big question that I've had in the back of my mind is why other churches don't imitate this model. And, you know, when I think about, you know, I do the economics of religion as well, and so I think of, you know, churches as firms in a market competing with one another. But when I think about the economics of organizations that people normally think of, your business firms, there's a great deal of imitation in organizational styles that you see between firms. That if, you know, take a fast food restaurant, somebody opens a drive-through or introduces a dollar value menu, you see a lot of other organizations adopt that pretty quickly. And what's always puzzled me in the realm of religion is we see a number of denominations that are on the slide, that they're losing membership, the commitment is waning. And I always stop and wonder, well, why don't they look at some of these other denominations, the Mormons, maybe Pentecostal churches that seem to be flourishing, and imitate some of these? I mean, the model that the Latter-day Saints offer just seems to be such an ideal model for any kind of church growth that other churches would adopt this. Any thoughts on that?
Boy, that's a big question.
Yeah.
I definitely don't have an answer that's going to wow you. I have two kind of answers. One I think is that leaders of different denominations, they do have, I mean, although any group's going to have to be concerned about maintaining their membership and growing, the emphasis that that mat takes is going to differ from group to group, and so that could be part of it. But I think another way of thinking about it is a lot of groups do mimic some of these features. Mm-hmm. Maybe not necessarily to the same extent, and maybe not exactly in the same way, and definitely not because they're explicitly trying to mimic the Mormons, but just because good organizational practices tend to win out. Let me mention mega churches. So I listened to the podcast with Mark. That was really enjoyable. Mark and I have actually talked about this, and we've kind of shared our ideas together a bit on this. And I think mega churches actually do this. And there was an undergraduate student here who actually wrote an honors thesis on studying a local megachurch here in Orange County and looking at some of these ideas that come out of my Club Mormon paper and trying to see to what extent they match what the local megachurch was doing. And he found that they actually do quite a bit. Now, they don't describe things the same way. They don't use the same language.
Right.
But there's lots of things going on, lots of outreach and missionary, lots of things specifically set aside for visitors. Lots of ways they design the benefits of the group that actually make it so that it's just natural that you can't even receive certain benefits unless you up your commitment. Say, a lot of benefits from being in a weekly break-off group you can only get by going to a local break-off group. So if you make the break-off groups a key part of your organizational logic, then it just naturally happens that the people that are participating more get more of the benefits.
Right.
Why is it that maybe a mainline denomination doesn't mimic these to more extent? That's a good question. I don't really have a great answer to that. But I do think that in terms of the religious groups that are growing rapidly, I think there are going to be a lot of organizational similarities. Just because it's what I'm talking about is an organizational issue, and it's a common, this free rider problem is just a fundamental problem that the group has to solve.
How does this organizational feature transfer across cultures? I mean, you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that a Mormon ward in Salt Lake City is going to pretty much look like one in Alabama or Nigeria. Has there been any studies looking at difficulties in other cultures or anything?
Boy, that's a good question. I don't really have a good answer for that. I would suggest that the similarity between a Mormon ward in Nigeria and one in Utah is more specifically by design. But lots of churches allow a lot more local variation at the congregational level, where congregations are a lot more autonomous. And there you might see much more variation where in Nigeria, say, a lot more use of traditional drums rather than an organ, for example.
Right, right.
So you do see variation like that. My main background is as a type of economic theorist, and so putting on my theorist hat, I would say, the free rider problem is just a fact of organizational life. Mm-hmm. In clubs and in these religious groups, they're going to have to confront it, and they may do various methods of trying to confront it, but they're going to have to if they want to succeed. So my theorist hat would say, this is the answer. Now let's go see if the evidence matches it, and maybe there's just not maybe the work's just not there yet. Maybe this is one of those topics for future research.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things we try to do here on Research on Religions, to provide different avenues of research. And one of the things I enjoy in talking with a number of our guests is we come to these questions that we go, I'm not quite sure why that might be, or maybe we should look at that a little bit closer. But I share the same, I guess, the same bias as you do, this universal outlook on life. Is that a collective action problem? And Utah is the same collective action problem they face in Nigeria or Argentina.
Yeah. That's what spurred the project by that student here. He wondered, he had some connections at a local megachurch, and he had read my paper, and we were talking about it and saying, the ideas in my paper, they should translate.
Right.
See if they do. And lo and behold, he found that they did to a large degree. Now, hopefully that wasn't just a result of him putting on blinders.
Right, looking for the answer.
Looking for something and really finding what he was looking for, but in a biased way. But I don't think that's what happened.
No. That sounds absolutely fascinating. Well, we're coming to the end of our podcast here, and I want to thank you for participating in our discussion. I've learned quite a great deal from your papers. I'm not all that familiar with the Latter-day Saints, and so this was a wonderful introduction, and I encourage a number of our listeners to actually check out your papers online. We'll provide links to them, and also make sure that you tune in to us weekly. We do have a Twitter feed if you'd like to get weekly updates on the upcoming episodes. And so, Mike, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.